I'd like to welcome Terry Fair. Excuse me. Terry is our speaker for today, and I have a short bio. Maybe she'll add some information. I think many of you were here for her earlier sermons on love and compassion, and now her topic is forgiveness. Terry is a Unitarian Mennonite, or vice versa, who has done some time as a Catholic and has some decidedly pagan tendencies. She has spent the last 12 years working as a psychologist with the Correctional Service of Canada at Saskatchewan Penitentiary. She now lives here in Regina and works at the Oscana Centre. She also maintains a small private practice with PAR consultants and counselors. Terry believes in the free and responsible search for truth and meaning, and that healing does not take place in a spiritual vacuum. Terry, welcome.
Good morning. Whoa, that was loud. As some of you know, I'm a singer and I project, and people often complain that I'm yelling. I'm not. I'm just being emphatic. Today I'm going to talk about forgiveness, and you will hear some decidedly Christian overtones in the course of my talk this morning. And that's because Christianity is one of those sources that we get a lot of information, a lot of our beliefs from. Christianity thought forgiveness was so important that they institutionalized it. It's important to remember that despite the way things have gone historically, Christianity was at the forefront of this thing called forgiveness. I think we maybe lost the way somewhere along the line. So I want to tell you a story about what I would consider to be my greatest life lesson in forgiveness. As some of you may have heard this story, because I tell it often in conversation, and so I hope it bears repeating. From 1982 to 1984, I lived and worked in Nigeria as a CUSO volunteer. Now, that's 100 years ago now, or thereabouts, and I still remember it very clearly. While I was there, and I still tear up when I tell this story. While I was there, I fell in love with a beautiful Egyptian man. And knowing the difficulties we might face, I prayed that we would have 2 good years, because I knew that that's how long I would be there, 2 years. And God answered my prayer. I had God being, you know, the universe or whatever you call that, right? I got 2 years, 2 good years with this man. And then we thought we would try to stretch that 2 years out. And at the end of 2 years, we decided we would get married and we would live in Canada. Our planned trip home from Nigeria even included a week on the beach in Greece, me in the sun, and Sayed in the shade, so that we wouldn't look so different when we came home. We didn't make it to Greece, but that's a story for another talk. Sayed came to Canada with me, but had to return to Egypt to arrange for his immigration. By then, I had already begun to feel the social and the economic pressure. Remember that I grew up as a Mennonite, and my father said to me, but he doesn't believe in God. He believes in Allah. So there was this this separation, it's cognitive disconnect between what was real and what was perceived. Two people, Syed and me, of different colors, cultures, religions, it was going to be a lot more difficult than I had anticipated. And eventually, I lost courage. In my final letter to Syed, I asked him, sorry, I thought I could do this without doing this. I asked Syed to please forgive me. Several weeks passed and I didn't think I was going to hear from him again. But then, one day, his reply arrived. I still have the letter. He wrote, and I paraphrase here, "How can I withhold forgiveness when God himself forgives me for my wrongs?" Behavioral and educational psychologists have demonstrated that pain is an excellent, albeit somewhat dysfunctional, teacher. When a child touches a hot stove, the learning is immediate. I might add that when I was trying to teach, I had a dog named Macbeth many years ago, and I wanted to teach him to run beside me on the bicycle, and he kept pulling and tugging ahead, and I said to my friend, "Sue, what am I going to do? He's going to get caught in the spokes." She said, "Let the spokes nip his nose, and he'll never do that again." And sure enough, she was absolutely right. So the child, or the dog, may not understand why, but he will know to stay away from the hot stove or the spokes of your bicycle. He might even be afraid of the stove for a while. As we mature, we learn to make sure the stove has cooled before touching it, to be careful. This does not mean we quit cooking, although not such a bad idea. Nor does it mean we harbor ill feelings towards the stove. We do not blame the stove for our pain. We recognize that many factors came together to cause the pain and that accidents happen. We may even recognize that our own carelessness played a significant role in our pain. Pain is useful. Without it, healing would be very difficult, if not impossible. Whether it's physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual pain, it tells us that something is wrong and needs our attention. Through the process of exploration, learning, and understanding, we can often find solutions to the problem and alleviate the pain. For example, many of us have chronic conditions. As we live with these chronic conditions, we learn to manage them with medical and lifestyle interventions so as to minimize their intrusion on our daily lives and to enable us to live a full and rich and satisfying life. Despite them, the pain may not ever completely disappear, and we may never be able to forget that we are living with a chronic condition. We may not like having whatever it is, but we accept it as part of ourselves and we carry on. Relationships with others can be disrupted in small and large, but always painful ways. To be clear, a relationship is not limited to the connections that exist between us and those who are close to us. The media allows us to have relationships, however lopsided, with any number of folks we have never and will never meet. We can feel betrayed by our politicians. Certainly every time I open my Facebook, I feel that sense of betrayal. Clergy, the world leaders, hurt by public misperceptions and judgments, and in return, we can be equally hurtful and judgmental. And if you have a social media feed of some kind, you will see this. Anyway, I won't go in. We can talk about that later. Whether we are givers or receivers, forgiveness is the process through which we are healed of the damage that caused the pain in the first place. By opening ourselves to the process of exploration, learning, and understanding, we can find solutions to the problem and alleviate the pain. What happens, though, in people who resist the process? Research tells us that resistance to healing actually increases the intensity of the pain we experience. Furthermore, resistance to healing often leads to depression, irritability, anger, despair. Resistance to healing can cripple us in more ways than one and cause us to inflict even more damage, requiring even more forgiveness in the end. So here's a story about forgiveness, and just bear in mind that it's a story. I'm going to read directly from the Bible here because I wanted to make sure that I got the story right. So one of the Pharisees asks Jesus to eat with him. So Jesus went into the Pharisee's house and sat at the table. A sinful woman. You all know what that is, right? A sinful woman in the town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, so she brought an alabaster jar of perfume and stood behind Jesus at his feet, crying. She began to wash his feet with her tears, and she dried them with her hair, kissing them many times and rubbing them with perfume. When the Pharisee who asked Jesus to come to his house saw this, he thought to himself, if Jesus were a prophet, he would know that woman he's touching him is a sinner. Jesus said to the Pharisee, Simon, I have something to say to you. And Simon said, teach me. Jesus said, two people owed money to the same banker. One owed 500 coins and the other owed 50. They had no money to pay what they owed, but the banker told both of them that they did not have to pay him. Which person will love the banker more? Simon the Pharisee answered, I think it would be the one who owed him the most money. Jesus said to Simon, you are right. Then Jesus turned toward the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? When I came into your house, you gave me no water for my feet. She washed my feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. You gave me no kiss of greeting, but she has been kissing my feet since I came in. You did not put oil on my head, but she poured perfume on my feet. I tell you that her many sins are forgiven. So she showed great love. But the person who is forgiven only a little will love only a little. Then Jesus said to her, your sins are forgiven. So the woman in this story has a bad reputation. Simon the Pharisee thinks of her as a sinner, unworthy of Jesus' attention. We've all had thoughts like Simon's, and we've all known people like this woman. They've made mistakes, gotten into trouble, found themselves on the wrong side of the law. God knows I know lots of those. Or they've been marginalized through the spread of malicious gossip. Sometimes their early circumstances and choices have resulted in long, hard, and painful life paths from which they felt it impossible to escape. I often wonder if these aren't the people into whom we project our own shortcomings After all, without them, who would we feel superior to? Okay. Let's just take a minute to imagine her pain. How lonely she must have felt. Her despair, her sadness, her feelings of helplessness and hopelessness, her shame. She has hit bottom. She has nowhere to go, no one to turn to. Perhaps the alabaster jar of expensive perfume is all that she has of any value. She is drowning in pain. Suddenly, she has an inspiration. Perhaps Jesus, that fellow who's been doing miracles and healing people. Maybe he can help her. She takes the jar and goes to Simon's house. At the sight of Jesus, she begins to weep, flooding Jesus' feet with tears of despair. She sheds copious tears. With her tears, she washes Jesus' feet, and with her hair, she dries them. And she gifts him with the perfume. Her tears speak for themselves. Jesus does not ask why she weeps or what she has done wrong. He simply allows her to pour out her pain before him. And then he says, your sins are forgiven. On October 2nd, 2006, in the Amish community of Nickel Mines, a gunman, Charles Carl Roberts, took hostages and shot 10 girls, ages 6 to 13, killing 5 before committing suicide in the schoolhouse. Police reported that there was not one desk, not one chair in the whole schoolroom that was not splattered with either blood or glass. There were bullet holes everywhere. Later that same day, a grandfather of one of the murdered girls was overheard saying, "We must not think evil of this man." Another Amish father noted, "He had a mother and a wife and a soul, and now he's standing before a just God." A member of the Brethren community living nearby explained, "I don't think there's anybody here that wants to do anything but forgive and not only reach out to those who have suffered a loss in that way, but to reach out to the family of the man who committed these acts." An Amish neighbor comforted the Roberts family within hours after the shooting and extended forgiveness to them. Amish community members visited and comforted Robert's widow, his parents-in-law. One Amish man held Robert's sobbing father in his arms, reportedly for as long as an hour, to comfort him. About 30 members of the Amish community attended Robert's funeral, and Maria Roberts, the widow of the killer, was one of the few outsiders invited to the funeral of the victims. Marie Roberts wrote in an open letter to her Amish neighbors, thanking them for their forgiveness and grace and mercy. "Your love for our family has helped to provide the healing we so desperately need. Gifts you've given have touched our hearts in ways that no words can describe. Your compassion has reached beyond our family, beyond our community, and is changing our world. And for this, we sincerely thank you." I cannot imagine that this community has forgotten or will ever forget the tragic loss of their beloved children. The pain of loss will always be with them. Still, they forgave without being asked. After all, who are we to withhold forgiveness when God Himself forgives us? So if you can't read this, it says, I tell you, not seven times, but 70 times seven. And the guy at the back says, great. Not only do I have to forgive my brother, now I have to do math. When I was a child, I first heard the story of the unfortunate fellow who had the temerity to ask Jesus, how often do we have to forgive anyway? Is seven enough? Jesus replied, no. 70 times 7. 490 times is a lot of forgiveness. So, every time my nemesis bully Art would inflict another humiliation, I would try hard to forgive him again. I was 12. I didn't rat him out, as I thought that would be unforgiving. And if I forgave him enough, perhaps, I thought, he would stop. My understanding was limited. Little did I realize that my cognitive and emotional association with Art would go on for the rest of my life. Little things would happen to spark the flow of memories of his hurtful behavior, and I would launch into a full-blown mental hurricane of anger and resentment. And each time, for my own well-being and for the well-being of those close to me, I would have to forgive him all over again. I'm not certain how many times this has happened. I'm 63 and 490 sounds like a nice round number. Forgiveness is not an event. It's a process. Art neither knows nor cares how many times I've forgiven him. It really only matters to me. I found this video. I really love this woman. So she's a Lutheran minister, but as you will see, she's unconventional. And I'd like to just take a couple of minutes to watch it. Her name is Nadia Boltz Weber, and she's quite awesome.
I really believe that when someone else does us harm, we're connected to that mistreatment like a chain. Because forgiveness is nothing less than an act of fidelity to an evil combating campaign. So it's not an act of niceness. It's not being a doormat. It really, to me, is more badass than that. Maybe retaliation or holding on to anger about the harm done to me doesn't actually combat evil. Maybe it feeds it. Because in the end, if we're not careful, we can actually absorb the worst of our enemy and on some level even start to become them. So what if forgiveness, rather than being like a pansy way of saying it's okay, is actually a way of wielding bolt cutters and snapping the chain that links us. Like it is saying, what you did was so not okay that I refuse to be connected to it anymore. Forgiveness is about being a freedom fighter. And free people are dangerous people. Free people aren't controlled by the past. Free people laugh more than others. Free people see beauty where others do not. Free people are not easily offended. Free people are unafraid to speak truth to stupid. Free people are not chained to resentment. That's worth fighting for. there really is a light that shines in the darkness, and that the darkness cannot, will not, shall not overcome it.
So if you'll join me in a brief meditation. We often feel vulnerable to the dangers of the world, both known and unknown. The resulting pain, fear, and anger interfere with our ability to be loving, compassionate, and forgiving. It's so hard to let go of our emotional attachment to the wrongs and focus on the need to let go, make things right. May we be blessed with faith and courage to seek, accept, and offer forgiveness without condition. Thank you so much for listening to me this morning.